are you speaking to us?
Calling you up, Chris.
So I copied each of you on an email. I just got Helen Clausen accusing me of a federal offense in having Randy buy my boat on the garage. And with his contribution.
How do you find that out?
You know, Tom, it's just
he made a contribution?
Well, early in my campaign.
Oh.
And Alan said...
Oh, not right after the vote?
No, Alan said, do you see why people might see the appearance of undue of improper influence? And I said, no, I a contribution from a friend and a future colleague.
You should tell him I gave you like a $20,000 contribution.
Oh, that's right, isn't it? I wasn't smart enough to do that. I wasn't clever enough in my response.
That's all in the Cayman Islands.
I copied each of you because it just reflected to me how obsessive he's become on this and how little perspective he has.
Yep.
It's almost like it's a form of...
Good afternoon, everybody. We're going to start the council. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Leonard? Saltzman?
Here.
Potter.
Here. Please read the first item.
Item 1647, Oregon Institute of Technology Sustainability and Mayor Klamath Falls Sustainable Energy Solutions.
Well, a few months back, I had the privilege of going down to Southern Oregon to visit some of the cities and counties in Southern Oregon, and I really enjoyed my time in Klamath Falls. And Mayor Todd Kellstrom and President Maples were a very gracious host and showed us around, and we learned a lot about Klamath Falls and the Oregon Institute of Technology. And I was really impressed with how they use their geothermal resources as well as what they're doing at the Institute to promote the work that they're doing there. So I'd like to invite up Dr. Chris Maples, the president of Oregon Institute of Technology, and Valerie Lane, the Chief of Staff at Oregon Institute of Technology. Just a little bit of a background about President Maples. He was appointed the 6th OIT president and began his duties on October the 1st. So he's kind of a newbie, and want to welcome you to Portland and Oregon, I guess. President Maples received his bachelor's degree in geology from West Georgia College and his MS and PhD degrees from Indiana University in geology with a minor in biology. He most recently served as Executive Vice President for Research at the Desert Research Institute in Nevada. And Klamath Falls, Todd Kellstrom was going to come up here, but has been unable to. And I understand we have a short video from Mayor Kellstrom. But I really appreciate you folks coming up. I know it's a long flight, or actually a short flight up here. And tell us a little bit about the school. I was kind of surprised to see how you're spread around the state, and particularly in the Portland area. So welcome to City Council, Doctor.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mayor. Commissioners, we really appreciate the opportunity to be here. And I'll be honest, it was a surprise to me coming to Oregon and OIT to find out how many places we were around the state. We have 4 campuses here in the Portland area alone, one near Clackamas Community College, one out on the west side at Amber Glen Road, one on the OHSU campus on the hill. We have a building there that we lease from the OHSU for our clinical lab sciences, and one out in Tualatin near Wilsonville where we do paramedic work. We have a campus that we do dental hygiene in La Grande. We even have a campus in Seattle at Boeing, where we work with Boeing engineers directly. So it's really a nice place, a nice school, interesting students, terrific faculty, and the first renewable energy engineering degree in the country. We've gotten quite a bit of press about that, including some of the New York Times within the past year or so. It's helped lead OIT to a level of recognition that I think is quite good for the state of Oregon across the board. We are one of the top 10 institutions, baccalaureate degree institutions in the U.S., according to the in the Western U.S., according to the U.S. News and World Report. And bear in mind that Western U.S. goes from Texas to California and includes those states. So it's a huge number of schools. We are highly regarded in a lot of different ways. It's just a terrific place, and I'm thoroughly enjoying Oregon. It's a I probably shouldn't say this on the record, but I feel like I traded up from Nevada.
You did.
How many students do you have enrolled?
A smidge over 3,500 collectively. There are about 2,500 on the main campus in Klamath Falls, and then another 1,000 at the other campuses that we have scattered around. And it's primarily a polytechnic institution focusing in engineering and health, allied health science areas. Our students graduate, and approximately 98% of them get jobs within the first month or two after they leave. The average wage of those jobs is over $50,000 a year at this point. We have what I consider to be a fairly recession-proof student population when they get done. A number of our students who don't graduate because they go ahead and get job offers that they can't refuse, and they just take off and do them and then come back and finish their degrees later.
What's your mix of public and private dollars that support your work?
We are primarily, as a state institution, one of the institutions in the Oregon University system. We get about 50% of our support from the state in terms of state dollars coming into the campus. And the rest of it is tuition and foundation support. We have a lot of scholarships that we provide to students. We have probably 90 different scholarships that we provide to students at different levels.
Tell us about your unique opportunity laying beneath the ground.
That's what today is about. And we really enjoyed your visit down in Klamath Falls, by the way. We sit in an area where there is quite a geothermal resource. And what the city has done is has tapped into that geothermal resource to do things like heating sidewalks, providing additional power here and there. We do a lot of heating of the Klamath Falls campus with geothermal, and what we have planned for the future is to drill deeper, get a hotter water source, and actually build a power plant on our campus that will allow us to go completely off the grid. And that's our goal, is to be off the grid in a few years and even selling some power back by doing a geothermal exploitation here. It was a great visit that we had, by the way. We thoroughly enjoyed showing you some parts of that, including our local microbrewery that uses geothermal for a lot of their process.
You showed the mayor the microbrewery?
We did. It wasn't really open at the time.
The mayor was there strictly in an official capacity.
Official.
That's right. And
we
once
all
they cooled
were there
the geothermal
in...
down, it was quite tasty when you mixed hops with it. Well, tell us more about the school. I was just so impressed. It's a beautiful campus.
Thank you.
Spread out over several hills there. And has a very good relationship with the city. And
it is. It started in 1947, actually, to work with returning veterans from World War II. And it started with a whole variety of more technology, VOTEC almost type of offerings at the time. There has been a 60-plus year progression toward more of an educational set of opportunities, a lot more in the engineering, especially engineering where you can get some sort of a professional engineering license at some point at the end. And now, recently, in recent years, primarily led by the vision of former President Martha Ann Dow, health sciences and health-related activities, particularly technical health. The health field is changing so rapidly with so much instrumentation. that there is a real need for people who can do all kinds of imaging work, imaging technologies, nursing, all kinds of health-related activities, dental hygiene. So we're really trying to serve the need of the state and the region in requiring these types of jobs and filling these types of jobs across the board.
With your engineering program, how do you fit together with the existing program, say, at OSU and the new program that's been developed at Portland State?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. What we're doing is working together in many respects, and bear in mind that what OIT is primarily at this point an undergraduate institution. Our method of delivery is one in which we have fairly small classes, very hands-on. It's a very applied, hands-on type of learning institution where our students do a large number of internships and externships. So the type of learning in that engineering is a little different than you would get at the larger institutions in the state. That said, a number of our students will go into a graduate program when they are done. And most often they will go, I think, in the state of Oregon. It works out well for them to do that.
Is there a what kind of pipeline do you have with the Silicon Forest here and our high-tech employers? Do your students fare well in those kinds of opportunities?
They do, and we just had an alumni luncheon, in fact, with a number of our Intel employees and alumni. And so, yes, they've fared well in there. We work up and down the West Coast in many areas. We have well over 100 alumni, for instance, and I didn't realize this when I was living in Reno, Nevada. We have well over 100 alumni working at a place called International Gaming Technology in Reno. And so we have several hundred alumni working at Boeing. We have probably a couple hundred or so working at Intel. We do well up and down and provide a high-tech workforce that will help these type of companies come into the area and expand and develop. The workforce is one of the things that holds a lot of companies back, that's one of the things that I feel like Oregon does a pretty good job at, is providing that workforce because of the overall state support for higher ed, which is critical.
Well, I was curious. You talked about your new renewable energy engineering degree.
Yes, sir.
And I guess I'm kind of curious what's in that curriculum that maybe isn't in mechanical engineering.
He's an engineer.
Civil
sure.
engineering, yeah. So, yeah, what is it that makes it a renewable energy engineer?
There's a lot of mechanical and electrical basic concepts that ultimately then apply to renewable energy engineering. And a fair amount of what we're doing in the renewable energy engineering is building on our strengths in the mechanical and electrical engineering, but doing so in ways in which you're solving problems that are specifically applied to renewable energy systems as a collective whole. So that we are producing people who are able to go into these system type of engineering settings and go to work for solar companies or wind companies or even companies that are looking to make smaller plants that would go offline in small settings and would rotate back and forth between different types of renewable opportunities, so that it would be wind one day, solar the next day, maybe a little bit of biofuel or biomass another day. And much of this also then feeds into the battery technology itself as well, because the batteries are a real key in a lot of the renewable energy systems.
I'm just curious, if you were in Salem today, you'd be asking for more public support for your programs. But since you're before the Portland City Council and you have some operations here within Portland, what can the city of Portland do to contribute to your success?
That's also a really good question. If I were in Salem, you're right. I would be asking on behalf of a lot of the institutions here for support, because I truly view this as an investment in Oregon's future, and I will scale it to this is an investment in Portland's future as well. What we are doing is producing students who will go to work in really good high-tech areas here, who will help solve some of the problems here, who will know whether or not it is feasible to drill underneath the hill where OHSU is and bring on some of the geothermal that might be there. some people who are going to solve some of the problems as population pressure continues and as we move forward in a global society. This is, in many respects, I view it as investment with a direct payback down the line. And ways that that Portland can help, I would flip that around to a certain extent and ask how it is that we, as one of the campuses here in the city, and there are a number, how can we help you? How can we help you promote an overall Portland agenda as a renewable city, a green city, a good place for people to live, something sustainable down the line? We would like to be a part of that, and we would be delighted to help.
So I met with some of your folks in the room. We're putting together the Sustainability Institute here, and intended to be a partnership with the private sector, the nonprofit, government, academia. And so we've had you and some of your folks in those initial discussions and really appreciate it.
Absolutely, and they were appreciative of being there. We are grateful to be part of that group, and the way you described it in terms of public-private partnerships, that is truly the path forward here. I don't think any one sector is going to be able to do this entirely alone.
Have your graduates fared well to the extent, and any have had an interest in working for the city or any of its bureaus?
I'm sure they have an interest. I don't know how much of an opportunity they have had at this point. I just don't know. They may have had lots of opportunity, and they may have gone to work for the city, and I would have to do my homework on that to track it down.
I believe our last count, we had about 10 employed by the city of Portland.
Okay. So 10 at last count employed by the city.
Valerie, is there anything you'd like to add to this?
We just truly appreciate this opportunity. Oregon Institute of Technology is part of the overall Oregon University system. And to be part of the change and progress for our state is phenomenal. And we realized that when we started operations in the Portland area in 1983, that this is an area that we will always have an opportunity to grow and emerge and evolve into an ever-changing, progressive institution for the state and for our metropolitan folks. So we appreciate this opportunity.
Good. Well, Mayor Kjellstrom is one of the folks that come up every, the last two Rose Festival Grand Floral Parades to walk in the mayor's marching unit. And so I've really enjoyed getting to know him then and then our visit to Klamath Falls. I understand you have a brief greeting from the mayor.
We do.
Good afternoon. I'm Todd Kjellstrom. I'm the mayor of the city of Klamath Falls, and it's my pleasure to be here for you today. I'm sorry I can't be there in person. Tom, I really appreciate the invitation and appreciate your visit down. You and Carl came down and had a wonderful time here, I hope, and saw what we were doing here as far as sustainability in Klamath Falls.
Klamath Falls is the county seat for Klamath County. The area is commonly known as the Klamath Basin, which includes an area that extends into Northern California. It's a rugged land that has caused its residents to value self-reliance, hard work, and perseverance. Sustainability has never been perceived as a luxury, but a historic necessity. The citizens of Klamath Falls know that sustainable living is not a fad, but a means toward a better way of life.
We're experiencing environmental degradation that is going to be compounding in our lifetimes. This is not something that's going to go away. It's not something that we can ignore anymore. All of our indices, climate change, water quality, clean water availability, air pollution, pollution in our bodies, creating medical problems, these are things that have compounded over the last 100 years. And there's finally recognition that we need to do some serious work on mitigating these problems.
Sustainability began with the original Native American settlers in the region. They made clothing from tules, baskets from pine needles, and revered the locations of numerous hot springs as sacred places. As homesteaders moved into the area, hot artesians were used to scald livestock during the butchering process and for health and recreation purposes. Klamath's close proximity to the Cascade Mountains provides ample geothermal resources, which are now used to heat homes, sidewalks, and commercial greenhouses.
If there's anything that folks typically know about Klamath Falls, it might be the geothermal resource that's down here. It's something that the community has taken advantage of for years. We've got downtown heating district. We've got neighborhoods that take advantage of those shallow geothermal wells for residential heating. This whole campus, in fact, is heated by geothermal wells. And the Oregon Institute of Technology, over the past couple of years, has applied for a few block grants through our Blue Sky Block Grant program. This is our renewable energy product. It's the most popular renewable energy product in the country right now. And in addition to making renewable energy available to our customers, it also creates a grant pool and dollars available to fund renewable energy projects throughout our service territory. So the Oregon Institute of Technology actually has a project going over in Lakeview, Oregon, which is about 2 hours away. And they're doing a renewable energy demonstration project, and we were able to give them $25,000 to help make that project happen, and it's just about complete. Ron Wyden was down recently, our senator, and he was able to announce the $100,000 Blue Sky Block Grant that we were able to provide OIT this year, and that's going to help OIT develop a low-temperature geothermal energy project. So that was pretty neat.
Oregon Institute of Technology will embark on two electric generation projects in the near future. The first will utilize existing resources already used to heat the campus. Its 195-degree water will power a plant to provide 20% of the power needed at OIT. The 280-kilowatt plant will also serve as a demonstration for those interested in power generation and be a hands-on laboratory for OIT students. The second project begins with drilling a deep well of up to 6,000 feet. Geochemical analysis indicates the water of 300 degrees can be found at this depth. This temperature will power a 1.5 megawatt plant that will take OIT completely off the grid.
We will be the first campus in the world to get all of their energy from directly on campus from geothermal energy. And will be the first power plant in the state of Oregon as well.
OIT's GeoHeat Center is one element of the Oregon Renewable Energy Center, which is sited at OIT. The GeoHeat Center is an international clearinghouse for information on the resource.
OIT has been a sustainable campus since 1974. We've had the GeoHeat Center since then, and the GeoHeat Center has worked with the city of Klamath Falls on numerous projects, especially downtown, with providing geothermal consulting on heating projects, electric projects, and also things like heating sidewalks. Great partnership with the city of Klamath Falls. OIT, in terms of being a green campus, is far and above a leadership in sustainability in the state and in the nation.
Geothermal may be the cornerstone of sustainable Klamath, but it is not the only green activity in the region or on the OIT campus. The area boasts 300 sunny days each year, which provides ample resource for solar technologies. The city of Klamath Falls recently completed a feasibility study for the use of solar panels to power the waste treatment plant. There is also the potential to create a solar farm to energize all city government buildings. The water treatment plant also factors into two other sustainable initiatives. Dried sludge is mixed with chip vegetation to create mulch that is highly sought after by gardeners. Mayor Kellstrom says people have to make appointments to get the fertile mix. Methane, a byproduct of the plant, is being considered as a biofuel for city-owned vehicles and has potential for producing electricity. Biodiesel is an endeavor that brought local agriculturists and academics together. Through the Oregon Renewable Energy Center, students from a variety of disciplines work on real-world projects, such as an electric hybrid car and a small biodiesel production plant that utilizes campus waste cooking oil. One passionate student began attending community meetings about sustainable practices and overheard a conversation about difficulties a local resident had with a seed oil press.
As a result of this cross-discipline project, we had a student out in the community overheard these community members talking about an issue they have in one of their sustainable practices, and he brought that back to the university, and then he and I worked on putting together a grant proposal and brought in another professor from the electrical engineering group, and that got funded through BEST, and so now we have this project where we're trying to control the moisture of the seed, oil seed, as it goes through the presses so that the presses will have the highest level of efficiency as far as extracting oil from the seed. And the end result is more oil and a better byproduct from the presses that can then later be fed to cattle.
Raising oil seed is not the only agricultural involvement with sustainability. Throughout the Klamath Basin, farmers, ranchers, and dairy owners are moving to organic products. Big John's Garden sells garlic online throughout the United States. The products are also available in retail outlets within the Willamette Valley. Rogue Creamery's cheese is produced from organic milk, which comes from select Klamath Holstein herds. At Liskey Farms, geothermal hothouses produce insect-devouring mighty mites, tilapia, organic tomatoes, and much more. Soon the farm will embark on its own power plant endeavor. A stone's throw from City Hall, tree seedlings begin their life cycle in geothermal hothouses, while at the other end of town, geothermal water is used to produce beer. In sustainable Klamath, citizens are born in a geothermally heated hospital, educated at a university that was the first in the nation to offer a renewable energy degree, and live to implement systems that will make life better for themselves and the generations yet to come.
I'm very proud of what we have accomplished in the city. Some of these things don't pertain necessarily to Portland, but again, I appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. And again, Tom, thanks for inviting us up, and I hope we can see you soon sometime. Thanks very much.
Very impressive.
Thank you. Yes, it's...
One other tie-up of this, the renewable energy engineering degree, the majority of the students in that degree are here in Portland. We have about 130 or thereabouts students, 80 of whom are up here in Portland.
Boy, that's great.
That's where this one has grown the most.
It's a potential pool of candidates for us, too. Huh?
Absolutely.
Yes. Valerie, did you want to add anything?
We do have some gifts that we would like to present to you, okay. And I hope that you all know that Mayor Kellstrom truly wanted to be here today, but given the proximity to the holiday, it was difficult to fit into his schedule. OIT is doing some really phenomenal work statewide, and as I was telling Stephanie earlier, I believe that all of us within the Oregon University system understand that it will take a consortium of education for our citizens of tomorrow to really take us to the place we need to be. And we thank you.
Well, Mr. President, I just want to note that you came to Oregon because of a job with Oregon Higher Education.
You bet.
And my wife and I came here because she was offered a job with Oregon Higher Education. So we have that in common. And if you could lend us some of those 300 days of sunshine, we would...
you don't need it today. It's a Chamber of Commerce day out there today.
Geothermal has something to do with that, too? I don't know, but... Sounds nice.
Well, Dr. Maples, thank you for being here. Thank you, Valerie. And I look forward to having dinner with you folks tonight.
Very much so. Thank you very much. And
thank you.
Thank you. And please tell Todd hello for us.
That's a good way to give us gifts. Give one to the attorney.
Thank you. Look forward to working with you.
Good to see you, Chris.
Thanks.
Please read the 2:30 time, sir.
Item 1648, adopt crime prevention through environmental design policy strategy for city-funded multifamily residential development and non-binding recommendations for private sector developers of multifamily residential development.
Well, I'm very excited about this presentation today because it's something that I've been thinking about for a long time. As a young police lieutenant 3 decades ago, I had the opportunity to go through some SEPTED training in Portland. And I spent the rest of my career trying to get the city interested in some SEPTED ordinances because I was so impressed with what the Fire Bureau did with their fire safety codes. And I thought, you know, the same thing should apply to personal safety as well to help prevent crime and to provide a safer environment for our community. And these folks are here today to talk about that. I think that it's going to be an exciting presentation. It's going to be a good presentation. And I hope that at the end of this, that the council adopts this because it's a good start on the road to making our community a better place for everybody. So who starts?
Well, we should identify ourselves for the record. My name is Jeremy Van Curen. I'm with Mayor Potter's office.
Rosie Sizer, Portland Police Chief.
Stephanie Reynolds, Manager of the Crime Prevention Program.
John Campbell, Campbell DeLong Resources.
Thanks, Mayor, for introducing today's SEPTED resolution. I'm going to talk briefly about the process through which we arrived at the resolution, and then I'm going to turn it over to John to talk about the content of the resolution. So Stephanie and I are both co-chairs of the Interbureau Task Force, and one of the ideas the task force has long discussed is finding a way to cultivate SEPTED in Portland. It was in the spirit of that ONI Crime Prevention coordinated a 3-day training in January to introduce SEPTED to city employees and key bureaus, as well as personnel from TriMet and other agencies. With that groundwork in place, we began meeting in the spring with staff from Planning and Development Services to find a way forward in elevating SEPTED values without reinventing the wheel or conflicting with other city goals. We also kept BHCD and PDC apprised of our work as housing projects entered that conversation. Through our meetings in the spring, we found that some SEPTED elements are already integrated into Portland's codes because they reinforce other values, such as pedestrian-friendly amenities. This information helped us narrow our focus to 3 areas we recognize that would benefit the most from implementing SEPTED principles. They are, first, city-funded development of any type; second, multifamily development, both public and private; and finally, other existing residential property. At the end of the day, we decided that the best approach would be to put our own house in order and work towards a resolution as a first step. Our goal was to require that any new multifamily building project or significant remodel project that receives city resources be required to include some very basic SEPTED principles in the design. We went through several iterations of a draft resolution internally with BDS and other stakeholders before we felt we had something solid enough in June to shop around to multifamily housing stakeholders such as HAP and the Oregon Opportunity Network. The input we've received from HAP and Oregon on PDC and BHCD since the summer certainly has shaped the resolution significantly. I'll go over some of the important changes that we made in response. First, we added a process to waive SEPTED requirements if implementing them would result in a higher total cost of ownership to the city, or if it causes an unanticipated conflict with other regulations. We clarified remodeling requirements to make sure it is clearly understood that if a builder wasn't planning on replacing something, this resolution would not require it. We brought in PDC and BHCD for implementing SEPTED for city-funded property because, as a funding agency, they are more familiar with housing developers' specific needs and have the ability to request these standards be met earlier in the design process than can BDS, which saves everyone time and money. And finally, we also adjusted some of the language and clarified some of the clauses to better emphasize the underlying purpose of the resolution. So I'm going to turn it over to John Campbell to talk about some of that clarification and the language of the resolution and also the underpinnings of SEPTED. Thank you.
Maybe I need to scoot down just slightly. Good afternoon. Is this picking up appropriately? I'm John Campbell, and I would like to describe just briefly a little bit about some of the underpinnings of the specific SEPTED elements that are being addressed in this resolution, and then describe in brief the the design concepts in the resolution. First, we noted that crime doesn't happen everywhere equally. It concentrates where opportunity is provided, and specifically what we're referring to with that is work by Wesley Scogan out of the out of Northwestern University, the Problem-Oriented Policing Center, and actually much other documentation with what crime analysts look at and others, determining that crime isn't a sort of evenly spread issue, but there are specific places where the opportunity is greater. Also, Robert Trojanowicz's work on the relationship between fear of crime and crime indicates that actually many people's average reaction to crime typically increases the likelihood of crime occurring, because what we do at those places is isolate and pull in and tend to hide and create opportunities for crime. And so this is looking at some key things that create more community connection and help prevent crime rather than find ways to identify it when it's happened. The goal is to make sure it doesn't happen in the first place. And there are some key findings associated with that, and I'll summarize those that relate directly to the SEPTED elements in this resolution, which Jeremy accurately described as very, very basic elements that would be recommended for all properties. Those are, first of all, the designed in hiding places such as opaque fencing, dense foliage, or dark alcoves, that type of thing. A property generally is going to increase the sense that one has an opportunity for concealment and therefore may have a greater opportunity for crime, and can also increase the sense of fear when people are going home at night and walking by places where they see dark hiding places and some of that. It reduces the livability for those individuals as well. Also, inconsistent lighting, creating glare blindness or deep pockets of shadows, can be issues. And I think it's important to point out that in interviews with the neighborhood response team officers, they said repeatedly, the issue for us isn't the amount of light so much as that it is consistent. Because if we're going in and we get the light bright in our eyes and we can't see what's going on and people have places to hide in the darkness, that doesn't work as well. So this is not about increasing energy, reducing the greenness of property, if you will, but looking at the consistency on some of those issues. And very frequently, the issues in common areas. I've done a fair amount of work with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development doing analysis at low-income subsidized and public housing, and unfortunately, there's a high consistency. When I am told about crime or assaults in laundry rooms, I almost don't need to look at them anymore to know that the issue is when you close the laundry room door, nobody walking by can see what's going on inside, and it can be more dangerous things. So those types of things increase fear and increase the opportunity for crime, and are things that are typically addressed in most multifamily housing today, but not always, and occasionally the city has funded property where there have been issues that have to be retrofitted. Also, a very basic thing that should seem intuitively very straightforward is that emergency response is more likely and more rapid where address numbers can be read. And, for example, we already require by code that there are lights that light up our address numbers. We don't require in our code that those lights be on. And our recommendation is, if the city's funding it, that they would require that the lights be on at night, which makes it easier to report and identify the address number, and certainly easier for emergency responders to find the location and arrive there more promptly as well, and certainly adds to safety from that standpoint. In addition, in-home safety, both the feelings of safety and the actual safety improve when two basic elements are in place, and this is where I'm talking about individual residents in their own homes. One is the basic ability for any resident to be able to see who is at the door without having to open the door. And just a basic fear issue and a basic knowing who's on the other side of the door should be fundamental, and it's not currently required in our code, and that resident doors and locks should be relatively difficult to kick in and force. This is not about banking hard steel doors and window bars or any of that, but simply solid core doors and good approved deadbolt locks. So deadbolt locks are required in all housing, but requiring ones that meet crime prevention standards can be beneficial because they slow down access. They cause a perpetrator to feel like it'll take me longer to break in, so I'm more likely to be seen and less likely to want to target this area. So those are some of the key elements. In addition, I should say that management of property is certainly easier, and I've done a lot of work, as I think some of you know, with managing properties around the country. But management of property is easier when the preceding elements are addressed, along with making sure that on-site offices, if you're building an on-site office, how about situating it in a place where it is easy to see at least one of the entryways or some of the common area, but some sense that the person managing has some connection to the area as well. We have seen properties where that has not been built in, but again, usually it is built in. And an obvious visual delineation between the public and private space. This is simply some type of psychological marker. It doesn't have to be a high fence, can be a low border hedge, can be even a low curb, something, or a change in color or texture of the sidewalk treatment, simply so someone knows when they walk onto the property, they're now in an area that is sort of in the domain of these residents and the management, and that the rules may be different. But those are examples of markers that the crime prevention program will certainly be looking at whenever they're looking at multifamily property and often recommending changes to help turn those properties around. We were aware of these things and looked at some of those things as common elements, and in the challenge in putting together a resolution that would fit with Portland is recognizing first, and I think it's important to emphasize, that many private and publicly funded properties already address these issues, but not all do. So this isn't about a dramatic change with most properties. It's about making sure that all properties that we are publicly funding are coming up to these minimums. It can be expensive to retrofit these, but it's essentially cost-free or cost-neutral to plan them from the start. It's pretty easy to put them in from the start, but it can be more expensive to retrofit. And that goes to a key element that the crime prevention program works on. The other elements necessary when there are problems at property don't require retrofitting. Those elements are, of course, improved resident involvement, better resident relations, and improvements, changes in management approaches and tone. Those don't require retrofitting, so this ensures the property is consistent with those elements. Also, the value here was cost-efficient implementation. It's about thinking differently, not more expensively, and the housing providers were very insistent that we say that even more clearly, and so we made sure that we did, because that really is the value here, and the elements should be Portland-compatible. The city is very well known for innovations in planning and design, and the intention here is to complement, not complicate, and so we did, I think, quite a bit of work with a number of stakeholders to make sure we weren't being redundant, we weren't developing regulations that were conflicting with other codes. With some of that as background, to review what's in the resolution will be a really quick review based on that will echo what I've just described, but there are two basic policy strategies. One is for city finance multifamily residential development and related remodels, simply because in a resolution we can mandate those things. It would take about 2 years to develop code changes to mandate it in the private sector. So the concept is to be leaders here, to say we believe in this, and so that we can make this happen in the public sector and make it and build the argument for suggesting that these should be automatic in the private sector as well. The basic policy requirements, again, for city-funded property would be requirements relating to outdoor walls, fences, hedges, or similar types of barriers, that they wouldn't provide a complete visual barrier. So examples are the built outdoor barriers should not be so opaque as to prevent awareness of an adult-sized person on the other side. Hedges above 3 feet will need to be not entirely opaque. They need to be able to see through. This is a dramatic change, frankly, from the type of SEPTED resolution or ordinances we saw implemented around the country. Well, they'll say things like no vegetation between 2.5 feet and 6 feet and something fairly dramatic. We said that doesn't sound like Portland. Let's just make sure that we're not creating those complete opaque barriers such as that high, thick laurel hedge, for example. And we wanted to make sure there was considerable room for screening or territory markings that will allow for a strong sense of privacy without, but still ensure that there is at least awareness of an adult-sized person on the other side of the given barriers. Regarding lighting, the concept is to minimize glare blindness and to leverage already required lighting to make sure it's installed in a way that avoids those types of issues. Again, it's not calling for necessarily more lighting, but saying to look at the design issues associated with that. And where lighting is used to light up address numbers or certain types of recessed areas, alcoves, key areas where it is appropriate to see access, such as a doorway, it should be on during the hours of darkness. Right now, the requirement, again, is that it's there, but not necessarily on. In addition, transition from the public rights of way, very basic requirement that there needs to be something, a change of pavement treatment or border landscaping or low fencing or something simply to indicate that psychological change from one area to another. I'm in talks with PDC, they say they consistently recommend this, and it's elements that they think are certainly valuable to have in housing as well. The common area facility should be laid out with visibility in mind. The play area should be where activity can be seen by residents. Every once in a while we see play areas that are sort of an out-of-the-way place that creates too much concealment. Laundry rooms should allow for some means of visibility in and out so that it increases both the feeling of safety and the perception that one can't get away with as much there, and on-site offices affording view of one or more exits. Again, very commonly these things are done. Housing Authority of Portland, for example, works to implement this and, frankly, much more security elements, but these are just some basic elements. And the final element for what would be required in the City of Portland would be that doors should effectively meet what's already in Title 33 offered as an amenity bonus. That is to say, Title 33 doesn't require these elements, but says that if developers put in eye viewers or some method to see who's at the door and meets certain basic door security requirements, which is why you see a fair amount of specificity in that in the resolution, that if those things are met, then the city will grant an amenity bonus, which allows the developer to create to develop more units, greater density in the same area. So certainly it benefits the and the city taking a lead in saying that valuing both the ability to provide additional units of affordable housing and to provide this kind of security, we would think makes sense. That basically summarizes the basic requirements that would be for required for city-funded property. In the private sector, multifamily development, again, with absence of the ability to go through a full code process, what we can do at this point is, and I'll simply reveal this because this really summarizes the entire policy, is to provide developers of three dwelling units or more of multifamily property non-binding SEPTED recommendations that would at minimum include the same recommendations that you just saw for policy strategy one for all private sector. We'd certainly hope that through this process that it would be encouraged that this would be done more consistently. ONI has a program in place that would certainly encourage private developers to do this very consistently from the start as well. But this goes as far as we can go at this point to sort of start setting that tone, if you will. Regarding the implementation policy, and there was much discussion from the housing providers about making sure that this was put in appropriately, the concept is that the procedures and practices would be the responsibility of ONI, but frankly in heavy partnership with the development services, housing and community development, police, fire, planning, PDC, and the housing authority, with particular emphasis with those dealing with housing elements. And frankly, part of the resolution is a method that raises and improves the conversation between the traditional silos of those who work in public safety and crime prevention and those who work in housing development and management as well. And this will certainly help facilitate that. The basic elements of the plan that are called for in that is that ONI would report back to you within 6 months with a plan that they would have worked out essentially with PDC, BHCD, and with BDS, that would, to the fullest extent possible, extend neither the number of days nor the number of meetings required for any developer involved in doing this. So we're not taking more of their time in doing this unless absolutely critical. So there's going to be a stiff test for that, essentially, that would implement the city-funded property requirements in partnership with the funding agency. And this was very important to the housing providers, saying, look, we already know how to work with PDC and BHCD, and they can inform us of these requirements and set those much earlier in the process than in the permitting process. And that would implement the private sector elements through BDS, which is essentially providing, at minimum, providing that information that we described. It would allow for waivers for elements that result in a greater total cost of ownership for the city, which, frankly, we don't expect that to occur, but we wanted to reassure that this really isn't about, we don't expect it to occur very often, I guess I should say. It really is something that should be cost neutral or a cost savings to the city. But if that's the case, there definitely would be a process to provide that. And also unanticipated or costly conflicts with other regulations that would allow for a waiver for that. No matter how much we review everything to make sure we're compliant with every regulation, there will likely be some things that come up as surprises or some things that aren't sufficiently clear and need clarity with that. We heard from developers who said, look, sometimes we'll get two different regulations, they conflict, and we're told that we have to figure out how to work it out. What we're saying in this resolution is if this conflicts with other city regulations, it's up to the city to work it out. That is to say, it's up to implementers ONI and the partnership team to say, okay, we'll figure out how to flex to make that work, because we're trying to avoid it being a greater barrier on those different elements. That essentially is a fairly hasty review of a very lengthy process and some good basic elements with that. So, and with that, I'll turn to Jeremy and then
Chief Sizer.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I'm here from the Portland Police Bureau to give a ringing endorsement for the resolution and the work of the task force. As you all know, the Portland Police Bureau responds when things go wrong. And we often respond to what we call chronic calls for service locations. many times in multifamily dwellings. When that happens, we ask NERD officers in particular to work with crime prevention and other city bureaus to achieve a couple things. One of them is a SEPTED analysis of the problem location, looking at things like doors and lighting, egress and ingress. And additionally, we work with management to improve screening of applicants and promote community of involvement among tenants. SEPTED principles, as it's already been pointed out, are clearly very cheap in the design phase. They are not expensive at all. They are certainly less expensive than the cost of victimization, both to the community and to individuals, and the cost of a criminal justice system, a police response to crime and disorder. And they make people feel safe, and they make them safer. SEPTED principles are really a huge no-brainer. Fortunately, there's not a lobby here against them. And I applaud the work of the task force and the mayor's and the city council's leadership on this issue. I think this is long overdue and very well welcomed.
Yes.
So I think this is very, very thoughtful work. Is it possible to, and maybe you alluded to this, Chief Size, in your comments, and I'm just so fixated on turkey tomorrow, I can hardly pay attention, that you in the Bureau, when you get repeat calls for service at a location based on what you think is an undue influence of environmental factors to its vulnerability for crime, that you follow up on that?
Yeah, actually we do. We identify chronic calls for service location. We usually at that point involve a NERD officer in crime prevention. Our strong recommendation to management is that they do have crime prevention do a SEPTED review and put together a remediation plan for any problems that are identified.
Are they required to do that?
They're not required to do it, but what happens through the chronic nuisance ordinance,
right,
if they get a certain quotient of calls for service, there is a mechanism in the city that is kind of arduous and time-consuming, but generally people comply when there's a sense that there would be a possibility that their basically property rights might be impacted. So I think generally we get fairly good compliance through that process. I think it's a great improvement that that there's greater consistency that these dwellings are built using SEPTED principles, so we don't get there in the first place.
Would
you agree?
I would absolutely agree. I have some comments that I was going to add as well.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I was going to say that the experiences of the crime prevention staff really mirror the experiences of the officers. When officers go to these chronic call locations, they really very quickly identify some very basic physical problems with the property that are very easy to pick out. Our staff does the same thing. We notice it right away. We get called out to do a SEPTED evaluation of a property about 100 times a year. At least that's what it was this last fiscal year. And we do these at both public and private properties. Housing for all income levels, it just doesn't matter. If there are certain design elements that are lacking, they are quite likely to have some kind of crime problem. And so we go to the property, we meet up with the manager or the owner or both, we do a tour around the property, and we're looking for very specific physical signs that there might be a problem there. We're looking for lighting levels, fencing, landscaping, signage, the physical layout of the property. And we make recommendations to the people who control that property about things that they might change. And I've got to say, the things that we recommend are almost always the exact same things that you find in this resolution. It's increased or improved lighting levels. It's improved visibility, improved eyesight on crucial shared common areas. And I've got to say, it's a lot easier to implement these things, just like the chief was saying. It's so much easier to implement these things when a building is first built than it is to retrofit them later on. And I also want to say that the experiences of the community match the experiences of officers and our staff. They also notice those specific dark alcoves, low lighting levels, overgrown shrubbery, and they don't think about it in the same way that we do, but it makes them nervous. And we get a lot of calls from people who are anxious to use their property or to pass through a certain area because they find that they feel anxious as they go through there. They feel vulnerable. When I was running the Women's Strength Program at the Police Bureau, extremely common for women to complain to us that they felt uncomfortable doing their laundry at night in their apartment complex because they didn't like to go into that room because you could not see into it or out of it. So I've, over the years, heard many, many complaints from people about the same sorts of physical conditions that we're talking about that could so easily be prevented from the get-go with a resolution like this. The chief was alluding to a program that our crime prevention staff implement that we've been doing for about 3 years called Enhanced Safety Properties. And this is a program that's a combination of SEPTED improvements, management training, and resident organizing that has had just a really magical effect almost on the properties where we've implemented it. And it was first piloted in North Portland. And Havala Frischweiler, who's back there in the bright red coat, she is our staff member who has been working the longest with ESP properties. And what she found as she was working with these properties is that initially the calls for service to the police go up a little bit because residents now know how to call for help, and then they just plunge because of the combination of the SEPTED, the management improvements, and the resident organizing. And SEPTED is, I know this is a very tired analogy, but it's one leg of a three-legged stool. And the physical improvements to a property make a huge difference in terms of the safety there. So, to conclude, our crime prevention staff is very much in favor of this resolution. We feel like it's long overdue. It's something we've wanted for a long time, and we really feel like the passage of a resolution like this will lead to reduced fear of crime for residents, reduced experience of crime for residents, greater ease of place management for apartment managers, less expense for building owners because they won't have to make as many repairs, and they'll have more stable, longer-term tenants because their tenants aren't afraid and moving on. And finally, less work for emergency responders and long-term problem solvers alike. So we're very excited about this, and we're looking forward to continuing our work in a Portland where we have more complexes that are safer by design.
Do you, the SEPTED analysis, you said you do over 100 a year. Is that available to homeowners too, or? I mean, if somebody calls and says, I want a SEPTED analysis?
Generally, yes, particularly if they have experienced some kind of a crime. So if somebody's, for example, been burglarized, we'll go over to their house and do it for them. We're also working on some sort of do-it-yourself SEPTED guidelines so that people can analyze their own living space or office space.
I know you've been working with the development community, nonprofit, for-profit, and HAP over some of the issues that were raised, and you've addressed them in the resolution. I appreciate that. But there's some questions I'd like to pose just to clarify the scope and the mechanics of how this works. And I'm not sure who I should direct it to, so I'll just frame the questions. And whoever it might be, John, you may be the one who, I don't know. But
sure.
Could someone explain to me how the waiver process works, who grants the waiver, and what is the due process rights, if any, to someone who is aggrieved if a waiver isn't granted?
I suppose a short answer to your question is no. As far as the what the resolution calls for is that ONI with PDC and BHCD would work together to define what that is and come back with that plan to council and say, here's how we've worked that out. And the idea is that with those housing partners at the table, it isn't that ONI simply makes up the waiver process and says this is how it is. The waiver process is something that would ultimately be managed by BHCD and PDC and would need to meet their experience of what works appropriately in housing and their architectural elements. But there is, I would say, there's further working out those details and reporting back. So what the resolution calls for is that process will be worked out and that ONI will need to come back with an implementation plan that specifies that. So that's the status of that at this point. But yeah, very, very important thing to have, I guess the technical answer is no. So
next, this by design would apply to city-financed development. Now, as I was thinking about the definition of city finance, it could take you in many interesting directions. And so I guess, have you thought about what would be the threshold of financial investment which would trigger this? And Would it also apply to all the direct and indirect ways which the city finances development? For example, would it be triggered by, I mean, some might argue that an abatement is a way we finance. Some might even argue that certain kinds of zoning changes or incentives, in effect, contribute. I'm just curious, what's the trigger and how broad is the scope of the financing?
I'm glad you asked that question, and that is something that we considered when we were designing the resolution. And we made a distinction between hard resources, such as financing, and soft resources, such as a tax abatement or a zoning application or something like that. What I can say for certain is that in cases of hard resources,